Welcome to the Agile Revolution podcast. In today's show, we'll be chatting about our first day at the Yao Developer Conference 2012. Unfortunately, due to a technical error, we were unable to record the last 5 minutes of the podcast, so you'll hear me cut in later, near the end of the podcast, to wrap it up. But for now, please enjoy the show. Welcome to the Agile Revolution podcast. I'm Renee, and with me today I've got, well, it's actually tonight, Craig.
Hey there.
And Pete Sellers.
Hi.
Welcome, Pete.
Hi.
Pete, this is your
debut.
We've been threatening to get you on 50 odd episodes, and we finally get you here. Welcome.
What a pleasure.
So this evening, we've just spent the whole day at Yao Brisbane.
It's our Yao 2012 Day 1 wrap-up extraordinaire extravaganza. That's it. And we have our drinks in place, right, Pete? Yeah, there you go.
Cha-ching.
That will need to cheer us up after the last session.
Now, I sort of get the feeling that we haven't really explained it in any of the other podcasts. We haven't covered it previously. Craig, you're here as a very special representative.
Yeah, I'm here.
As...
I'm doing a bit of work for Yao, let's just say that.
Doing a bit of your... So Craig's been frantically running around.
Someone has to make sure that PowerPoints are plugged in and water has been poured.
Oh, you're the water boy.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, can I fill you up there, Pete?
You've been doing an excellent job. So we're just going to quickly run through, you know, the day and as it's been and talk about what's been insightful, what hasn't, and... what you've thought about. So,
So for those who don't know what Yao is, let's just, what's a Yao? It's a crazy name for a software development conference here in Australia, and I include New Zealand because New Zealand doesn't have any software development conferences.
Oh, did you hear that, Dick?
Yeah, I think we do, but they only have Microsoft, so we don't count them.
There you go.
Ooh.
There you go, cha-ching. So it's the Australian Software Development Conference, and I guess the main claim to fame for Yao is that it attracts and brings out to this part of the world lots of world-class speakers and people that are leading in their field.
And Kiwis.
No Kiwis. You're the only Kiwi here, Pete.
That's what I meant.
Really?
I don't know. I just made that up. He's the only Kiwi on this podcast right now.
Excellent.
So, day one.
Day one, yes. Yeah. So my day started off with listening to... Oh, we had keynote.
Don Ryston.
Yeah, Practical Sciences of Batch Size, which was...
The principal, the author of The Principles of Flow.
Yeah, Flow, Theory of Constraints. It was all stuff that, you know, we spend plenty of time talking about on the podcast, so it wasn't too much revealing, I think.
I think the thing for me, and I've seen that talk twice... we don't see people like him down here in this part of the world. And I think the disappointing thing for me was that the message he had probably didn't mean a lot to the people in the room.
Yes.
There's lots of people that need to understand it. There's lots of companies trying to do lean. There's lots of managers trying to understand lean.
Yes.
And
I sat there thinking, God, I wish there were some CIOs, CEOs and senior managers in this room right now.
But even companies that are rolling out lean... disappointed me that, you know, I know a lot of them and there wasn't a lot of presence from some of those people. And it's not often that we see, you know, there's really only two big lean people in the software development stratosphere. And we had one of them out last year or two of them out last year, the Pop and Dex, and you got Don. And, if you want to know anything about lean, short of, you know, grabbing in someone from Toyota, he's your guy.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think it was really good to see him. And even talking to him, I've been lucky enough to spend a little bit of time with him away from the stage as well, and really passionate about what he does and educating people. He's not just sort of, you know, here delivering the same thing. He's got a wealth of experience behind him and knows his stuff.
And it definitely shone through. I think, you know, he talked about it in slightly academic terms.
He did tell me the story that when he wrote the last book... because on the slides he throws up some mathematical equations, and the publisher said to him, nobody's going to want a book with mathematical equations in. And he said that one of the biggest remarks he's had from people who had the book is that it's got the mathematical equations in there. So when you're really trying to get your head around what's going on, right? Did you know Don was the guy who introduced the cumulative flow diagram?
No, I did not.
He's the inventor of that. So
very impressive.
Hopefully, if we can snag him for a podcast at some point in the next couple of days, we'd love to find out some more about that.
That was a hint directed at me.
We've snagged him to come to New Zealand. He'll be visiting New Zealand later in the month.
He is indeed.
So for those people listening in New Zealand,
whereabouts in both Wellington, Auckland, or
no, just be in Auckland.
Just be Auckland,
which will be after this podcast.
So we should say, Pete, you're involved with the Auckland user group,
the Agile Professional Network.
Okay, people want to find out more about that. Where do they go?
Yep, they go to our meetup site.
It's the APN, right?
Yeah, I can honestly say I don't know the URL.
If you type in APN Auckland into the Googles, you'll find it somewhere.
So Renee will do some effort to actually put the link in the
show notes. Because obviously one of the people who organises has no idea how to find out where it is.
My job is the treasurer, not the website.
There we go. Right. So if you're going to make any money out of this podcast, you've just failed miserably. Any thoughts about Don? Pete?
I really enjoyed it. I had the same concerns as you in some ways, though, that the whole batch size and the control of the batch size really, for developers, it was the first real agile talk I'd felt that we'd had at Yale. Most of them have been, like, so really technical, and it was a breath of fresh air for me to have, especially a keynote that were on that topic, because developers sometimes don't really get around the whole concept. They're stuck into the technical aspects and that broadness. And
so if you were to take a video of that talk and take it back to your current company, do you reckon people would get it? Like, you know, like, I mean, I'm talking switching on people, but do you... Because we all get it because we're in the agile.
And I think the way that Don presents it and comes across in the presentation makes it really easy to understand the concept, and he proves the way that it benefits the companies. And if you fail to see the benefits from watching the presentation, then I don't know what you need to.
So ultimately the main thing he was really concentrating on was this whole idea of small batch size, and then through numerous examples of why doing things small really makes a difference. And I think that's what I liked about it. It was example after example after example to say, here's the things that, of why you want to do that.
I thought his lottery analogy was quite interesting, quite intriguing.
Or buying his eggs. Do you want to go and buy one egg and keep going back to the shop, or do you want to go and buy 100 eggs and store them?
Actually, when he was talking about it, I thought that I wasn't quite sure that there was an opportunity out there that was missing. You know, when you go and shop online at Woolworths or Coles, you go on and you're actually buying huge bulk items. You know, you're buying a whole loaf of bread, you're buying a whole carton of eggs. Well, what if you actually had a website where you bought recipes that you were going to make, and all you got was the bits that made up that recipe?
Isn't that a Master Foods mixer?
Master Foods mixer? What are you talking about?
Yeah, the things you buy in the supermarket where you just put the meat and the spag bog mix in and then instant spaghetti bolognese?
Yes, but better quality. So rather than having to buy, when you buy celery, for example, you have to buy like 10 or 12 sticks of celery, when generally most recipes only ask you to have two.
Yeah, but you got to dip something into your peanut butter.
You might.
It is the most frustrating thing about when you go shopping, though. Like, you do have a recipe, and then you end up buying, like, you buy this stuff and you need it for this recipe, and then you never use it again. There is definitely a market for that.
Thanks, Pete. What have I got you on here for? You're not supposed to stick up for Renee. Have you not listened to this podcast? I'm sorry, people.
We're starting that website next week. www.gettherightfood.com.
I thought you were going to say www.pickonthenay.com.
Shop me a recipe.
Shop me a recipe.
There you go. All right, patent pending, everybody.
Moving on.
So after the break, Fred George, you saw, right?
Yeah, so I mean, I have to resonate with Pete's comment earlier that there is quite a number of more agile talks at Yale this year.
I think the number's actually just the same.
It's just a bit clearer?
Yeah. But possibly. There is a clearer agile track, and I think it's because there's product design ones as well. So both Jeff Patton and John Henry Harris from Lego were in a product design track on their own, and then there's just some clear agile tracks.
So the next was, as you said, Fred George, who had Program Anarchy, and we've got a separate podcast which covers some comments from Fred George directly, who I would love to call the Weasley twins, but...
Nobody understands what you're talking about. So if you don't know Fred, and honestly, I must admit, I didn't know of Fred before the conference. So I don't know whether you had come across him or not. I certainly knew of Forward, which is where a lot of his stories were coming from. But he was telling me that just before the break, before we went on stage this morning, that he actually went to the conference ahead of the Agile Manifesto. He went to the one before, right? Nuts for picking the wrong one. I don't think I'll go to the ski resort. I think I'll go to the one before. So
I didn't even know there was one before.
They had lots of conferences leading up to the Agile Manifesto signing. So he's been around in the Agile. A lot to do with XP particularly, and Ward Cunningham and those guys. So been around for a long time in the industry and well respected, but probably more well known in the UK and the US rather than there in this thing, the Woods.
So he blew me away. Really great speaker. His message is more around, and I think it was very similar to what Agile was meant to be in those early days. When I think of what the manifesto was, it was all about developers getting back to developing. And it wasn't about business analysis, it wasn't about tests, it wasn't about PMs anymore. It was really, let us do what we need to do.
XP Mark II, right? He calls it programmer anarchy, but that's exactly what it is. It's XP without the stupid name.
And when you listen to him, it's sort of like, okay, do we really need testers? Do we really need BAs? Do we really need project managers? Do we really need managers?
Do we really need podcasters?
No, and the answer is no. I mean, yes, if his vision, if his world eventuates, I'm out of a job.
True. But I mean, there's lots of people who've had that same vision and lots of companies that actually make it work well as well. I mean, obviously, Ford, in the examples that he gives, is that they eliminated all those titles and are really now down to just, essentially a developer, and there's one other that I can't recall.
The customer. The
customer, yep. That's right, yes. That makes sense. but he's late. I've heard this message from lots of other people before, and it just comes down to the fact that it's like XP, and I don't think it's any different. XP worked if you had really good developers, right? And most implementations, you can't nod on a podcast, Pete. You have to say something. but if you got really good developers, then really good stuff happens, and I think that's what we lose track of sometimes.
As always, it comes down to really good people.
Yeah, but particularly with software development, it comes down to actually being not only good people, but be really good at their craft in development. Mm. You still have good people, but they've got to be switched on. Like, I've been in teams where I haven't needed a tester. And I've been in teams where they go, we need a tester, which is really just sometimes code for we don't want to do this, we don't have the time, or we need an extra safety check, or all those type of things. But if you've got good people, they can take it through. And if you've got engineering skills, you can go far. And that's why on the flip side, and Pete, you've been around when we've been talking about this, is that for testing, that's why we're trying to push testers to get more technical skills, right? All roles need to understand the domain that they're in, and if it's technical, so be it.
I was blown away by Fred, apart from the fact he didn't come out in his Quidditch stitch and kit and all that and fly across the stage, but it blew us away. And for me, one of the biggest parts of it was the context of what he was, where he was operating as well. I was sitting there at one point and he threw away continuous integration and all these practices that I love in continuous delivery, and I'm sitting there going, where's this guy going? And as he went through, it was the where they were working, the type of microservices they're utilising, made perfect sense that they'd taken, instead of just doing the practices for practice sake, it's about doing it in the right context. But to do that, you need to have the right culture and hire the right people. And someone did ask the question about hiring, and he did say it wasn't as simple as it maybe would be, but it was still interesting. You still need, for me, it's still about the culture and hiring the right people. And if you hire the right people and have got the right culture and you've got the right context, which they had the perfect scenario with all three of them, then it works for them. But I mean, would it work in
a big enterprise? He was talking about a very similar model to Google, wasn't he?
He did. He talked later in a later talk around the architecture, around the way it could scale to bigger projects and that. So it was new. But yeah, the presentation was fantastic.
So highlight of the day?
Highlight of the day for me.
No.
Easily.
Okay. No. We'll get there then.
Best quote though is fear is the mind killer.
Fear is the mind killer.
Mm-hmm. which I very much agreed with.
Yeah, and you know, it sort of comes along with some of the other things I think we've heard, like it's easy to say no, all those type of things come into that, right? Is that if you're scared of going and trying something, that's usually the emphasis that you haven't tried hard enough.
That comes from, like, it's the hardest thing is the leaders not being able to say no as well. I don't know about anyone else, but it's very rare we work with. You're not afraid to make a decision because someone's going to say no. And
Okay. Next in the Agile track was Dan North, who I must say, I've told you the story already, Renee. I was just thrilled to meet. Pete and I spent a lot of time in the quality sphere, and when he came bounding through the door in Melbourne a week ago, I was just like, "That's Dan North."
So if anybody listens to the podcast and understands how much Alistair Coburn is much loved by Tony, Dan is Craig's crux.
Yeah, I haven't had him to my house for a barbecue yet, so I'm not entirely sure that's a I've met a lot of people in the Agile world, and he's one I hadn't met. So, and a genuine nice guy to boot. Like, and I can actually say that for all the people I've spent I've been lucky enough to be able at this conference to be able to spend a bit of time offline, and Don and Fred, as well, right? Both genuinely nice people, willing to have a discussion, share a story, and even just watching people through the conference. So you've had
very approachable.
Everyone. I think that's the nice thing about the YAO conference is that the speakers haven't got anywhere to go, right? they're on the tour,
they're
so yeah. So as much as they're not told to be sticking around, but they do stick around and they sit in the back of talks. And we were in John Henry Harris's talk, and Jeff Patton's asking a question. That's pretty cool, right?
So Dan had a talk on embracing uncertainty.
Yeah, which is kind of his new name for
Accelerate Agile.
Yeah. Kind of the same type of thing, right? He's professing the same type of thing. Really, it's an analogous to what Fred was really talking about. I think it was a lot of the same themes.
Very, very similar. So, sorry.
There were a lot of the same themes, but for me, he took it into the enterprise level that Fred hadn't taken it into. He talked around the bigger concepts of the bigger projects, and that was what I liked about it.
I actually haven't seen the full talk here, but I did have the privilege to sit in here most of his tutorial last week, and same type of thing. Really, a guy who knows his stuff, guy who's really passionate about it. Yeah, you can sit in talks and you can see people that are just there. I'm sure it came across in the talk, particularly in his tutorial. Right? He was passionate. He was, people were hanging off him the entire break, asking him questions, and he was just lapping it up and answering the questions. And it's someone who really wants to solve problems. I mean, the guy came up with BDD. The guy, then built a tool to do it in JBehave. So, it's not as if he's a slacker, and not as if he's got this agile thing licked, but he's reasonably good programmer in his own right as well. So. They're the kind of people we need more of in the community.
So he had a great quote: fear leads to risk, risk leads to process, process leads to hate and suffering and Gantt charts.
Yes.
I thought it was really quite interesting. He basically went through in the presentation the Agile Manifesto and debunked it as if we had not made any sort of leeway on the journey. And I must say, it convinced me. Which I'm feeling.
So this will be the last episode of the Agile Revolution, and
coming next week that we've got so much
Renee on
more.
the waterfall
revolution. We've just got so much further to go.
Yeah. I think sometimes you can come out of talks like that and you can kind of go, oh, really, woe is me. We've come a long way. He's come to the conclusion around testing. I'm sure he talked a bit about testing, but this is the guy who essentially responsible for bringing BDD to the world, essentially going, maybe we didn't get that right. Maybe we need to rethink testing a little bit.
So to give an example, contract negotiation over customer collaboration. He goes and he talks about the fact that when you're doing Scrum, as an example, at the start of the sprint, you're effectively, in a lot of teams, making a commitment. It's a contract. True. Call it for what it is.
True.
others. Yeah.
But we're two people that are really keen to throw away sprints, though, right? So.
Yeah.
Sorry, sorry. Well, because for me, I'm a big fan of the BDD, Concordian, and the living documentation. And he kind of threw it in our face and said that, like, well, now we just concentrate on this big living document. And I was sitting there going, what's going on? That's the way that we can do things better. Mm. And then he went on to explain that, like, it wasn't just about the document, that it was about the value. And so
Interestingly, though, I think I'm in two minds about this. I've been talking to one of our, Adrian, who's been on our podcast, and he was telling me about how, at a rate of knots, he's pulling out cucumber tests out of his code base, because they're not adding any value. And I think, he's in that same position where he has a reason. I mean, he himself is a good developer. He's got a reasonable bunch of developers working with him. So the living documentation adds not a lot of value. I think there's some value in some documentation, definitely, and it should be backed up by tests. But this whole thing that everything should be backed by it.
Yeah.
So I think this is directly to us trying to come up for something for legacy testers to do, right?
I suspect that's true.
Yeah, and I think if you're going to have an organisation that doesn't want to let go of the reins on legacy testing, then living documentation and BDD is a great thing to do. But if you've got particularly if you're a small startup, if you're looking at value to come from the next thing, writing a cucumber test is not on my list of privileges. Writing a unit test certainly is.
But it's, for me, I've seen so many poor implementations of behaviour-driven tests.
True.
And if they're not adding value, rip them out.
Yeah.
But
the effort goes to write a good one.
Does it
give you the right value?
Write enough good ones that add the right value. So.
But if it takes a lot of time and expense to do that, is it worthwhile? And that's the question I came away thinking about after listening to him. And I've seen others talking about it. Done.
Excellent. Anything else? Moving on, after the break in the Agile track, there was I know
Corey.
Yep, with retrospectives, who needs them anyway? Again, we'll have I know on the podcast with a special one-on-two. Anyway, that sounds really sus.
I dropped in and asked a couple of questions. Anywho.
So, I guess with the depth that we have of experience in retrospectives, there wasn't a lot for me to get out of that. Messaging in there is about, well, what are the common failure modes? And it's not something that we haven't really talked about before.
Yeah, it was a talk that was done that was really focused on engineers trying to... To convince them that doing a retrospective is important, and if you're in the Agile path, there was nothing groundbreaking new in there. It just reiterated a lot of things that we already knew, Norman Kurth's Prime Directive, the retrospective book, getting actions, all that type of stuff. I did like a dating pattern in the middle of it, though.
Because you need help with dating?
No, I just thought that was funny.
Okay.
It's a good way of explaining pattern. Like she's very good at patterns. It was kind of a bit random where it was in the talk, but if I had to explain patterns to somebody, I've seen people do a really bad job of it. That was a really good way of.
True. The metaphors were really quite smart. Definitely. Did you go see something else at that time?
Yeah, no, I went to see the applying graphs to solve real world solutions.
Problems, you mean?
Oh yeah, problems. Yeah.
Cheers.
I wanted to go to one of the big data talks, and I've been spending time looking at graph databases and different types of databases and accessing data to try and come up with the right thing to use in the right place, the right context, etc. So I was interested to see in this talk what use of graph databases we would get. And he put the problems quite well. He gave some real world problems, which were around the local dog population, his ice hockey, and himself. And they're actually quite interesting little problems, and the way that he solved them using the graph database. And then he did start talking about graph database topics like traversal and what's the other one, statistics. And And it, for someone that was new to that kind of concept and wanted to just get a foot in, I found it really interesting, and it talked about a couple of the tools and why you would use the different tools. I can't remember the name of them, Titan, Folga, and some other unpronounceable Greek name. As an introduction tool, I found it really interesting. If there were people in there with probably more experience in that field, I don't know what they would have got out of it. But
so tell me, Pete, having done that, what would you use a graph database for?
Picking my best football team according to what he could do. There are a lot of ways to do it. You can determine by the statistics or the traversal and the deviation. It wasn't about what I was going to use it for. I just want to understand the difference between what would I get using a graph database as against the relational database. And it gave a couple of examples.
So graph database is what you use if you want to apply some sort of statistical querying on...
Yeah, it's more about relationships. Okay. And although you call it a relational database, it's not really as relational. It's... the graph databases can give you the edges.
I'm not getting it because can't you get graphs out of relational databases using apps?
All right, we're going to pause the podcast right now and explain to Renee what the difference is between a relational database and a NoSQL database, and we'll be back with you shortly. And we're back. Pete, she's still not getting it.
No.
Oh dear.
All right, moving on. Moving on, I had a coffee in the next one.
I must imagine you got anything there either. Pete, did you get anything in that session?
I did. I went to architecture without an end state.
Michael D. Nygaard.
Yeah.
Right, so the author of Release It.
Yeah.
Sounds like a really good song.
It was a really good presentation. He gave us 8 rules around the way, like, for architecture without an end state, and most of them were around taking out variability and looking at ways so that you could. It was more about just in time architecture rather than just this big behemoth.
And did he come to the conclusion that architects really need to code and that everybody's responsible for design?
Everyone was responsible for architecture and keeping them in the control. But
cool, all right, so we're learning under you. Awesome. Next.
It was a really good talk.
Yeah.
Then there was a really, really important, earth-shattering talk, one that's critical to us in our day and age, about Lego.
I thought this was a fun talk. There's always going to be something cool on the agenda. And it was packed. And who doesn't like Lego, right? So John Henry Harris from the Lego Creator Group, just explaining how they do stuff at Lego and... You wouldn't really learn anything directly from it, but it's one of those things that even after the talk, and I've said to you before, sometimes talks just hit me sometimes, and this is one of those talks. I think 2 days later, I was thinking about something. I'm thinking about they built that Lego set. Why the heck did they build a new little engine part? Why didn't they use XY? And I was thinking about that and trying to apply that back to software. That's really what he was talking about, was going through the whole process of how they design. Stuff.
I was very impressed with the different types of tests that they put it through, and there were things that I'd never
like the heat test to check the clutching of the bricks simulate being on a windowsill for 6 months.
More importantly, when they were talking about the leg design, and they talked about having to put a block position in to make sure that when a Lego object stands, that it doesn't tilt over so that it can stand up for about 4 months.
Mm.
And I thought, I actually thought back to Lego pieces that I've owned and that I play with, because I still have kids, so I play with Lego. And I could see that. And that just sort of blew me away, that sort of thought power went into it.
But even he went through, the building the plane and how they came up with their first design where there was going to be a biplane and went, that's going to be too hard. So they went to a single plane and it was, pretty boring. So then they got to this, weird-looking plane. But the thing I really liked was, how they get their four-year-olds in to test it, right? If anything's going to break, it's going to break with a four-year-old. And they're trying to show them this thing, and they go, isn't this great how this walks? And then we go, wouldn't it be great if it would fly, right? And it's that unbound thinking, but real product user testing and testing right up front, right? It's like, you can't beat it. It's no point putting the thing out in the market and then going, giving it to a four-year-old and going, that's crap. Right. Testing it straight up.
To test it, like, I love innovative ways of testing. I was watching something the other weekend there. So with your phone, apparently the biggest way to test memory leaks is when you turn the phone around. So this person just basically had a spinning thing that they put their phone on and just spun it around. I thought that was like, just not, like, you're not going to sit there and try and like write. Like, I would have sat there probably and tried to write some code to simulate this stuff. And this guy just said, nah, it's all good.
Yeah, so get a 4-year old or
get a 4-year old
or run a tractor through snow to see if it breaks.
Yep.
Yeah. And the other thing was the instructions, you know, how they. I haven't played with Lego for a long time, but I do remember as a kid the instructions for building that, and I guess I had an appreciation. Just, you know, I hadn't really thought about how well those instructions are crafted.
I can tell you the amount of times in the last 3-6 months that I've had to like undo half the Lego set because we missed one.
Yeah, I think someone asked the question in Melbourne, which I thought was really good. There's a couple, two questions got asked in Melbourne that didn't get asked in Brisbane. The first one was, you know, have we lost the innocence in Lego that that you could? There was only like 10 pieces. You know, there was only, you know, blocks that were 5 long and 4 long and 2 long and 1
no,
long.
No. I've still, I literally still have this Lego sets I had as a child.
Yeah, but have we lost the innocence now with all these new things, right? Yeah. With all these things that blink eyes and, you know, there's all these, like, there's now 6,000 pieces of Lego, right?
I still have a set that had at least 100 and something pieces in it.
But and they all link, but there are so many things. So, you know, your imagination.
There are very specialty blocks now. I don't deny that.
Yeah, so your imagination, you know, had to make something with, you know, the black, the red, the yellow, and, you know, and the 2x2 pieces, whereas now they've got all sorts of different pieces. And he didn't have a good answer for that except to say that at the end of the day, I mean, it's still about imagination and the kids.
Well, I think there's plenty of imagination because my kids lose the blocks all the time, so I have to imaginate, you know, alternate versions of
imaginate.
It that still work. Yes, it's a technical term. Look it up.
It is upsetting, though, with Lego, because I remember growing up as a kid and you used to just have a bucket and it had all the Lego in. And nowadays, I've got a young boy and we get quite a lot of the Lego, but I just want to go and buy a box with just the blocks so you can, you know, you can make
I believe you can
house.
Still do that.
You can still buy that.
Yeah.
I've not been able to find them.
Well, in Australia, when there is real shops.
And in New Zealand, where there are no shops.
I know, so the Lego shop just across there.
Really? Actually, I saw that at the window. There's a Lego shop right across the street. Yeah.
So that's where you got the speaker.
But the other thing someone asked, they went right with the hard questions and said, you know, all this seems to be focused on boys, right? Where's the focus on girls? And he actually told the story that they've just released some new Lego set, which is actually selling.
You're talking about Belleville?
No, it's got something else. Something like, it's like all about friends and things
it's
like
called
that.
Friends.
Yeah. And apparently that's been really successful. And the they actually spent a lot of time product testing that in the market. Yes.
Don't get me started on Friends. Seriously.
Not a good thing.
No, because and I was saying this to Aino earlier, but that they've actually done some psychological studies as well associated with Lego and children. Anyway, you can hear it on the Aino one, but less number of pieces for the same cost of the boys, less complicated pieces, less ingenuity going into it. It's going to be a downside to females in the programming space in the future.
That said, what he did answer for is he actually said that still in the Technics and the Creator range, right, they still have an awful lot of females that, or girls that actually play with those sets. It was just something that came from research. And again, I don't know, I don't work for Lego, but something obviously that they know they have to address. Anyway, we're not here to advertise Lego. But it was cool, nonetheless. And
I didn't go to the Lego.
What did you go to?
No, I went to see... Michael Feathers was ill, so I went to see Fred George, gave another talk on the mini microservices, and talked around his introduction to the... from 2004, I think it was, when he was working on this million line of code application in India and the issues that they had there, all the way through to his journey of using microservices at Ford, I think, or Ford is it, that he's working for now, and was really just a journey through where they were trying to introduce these microservices and the pub-sub models, and the number of times they were rejected, and when they eventually got this stuff into Ford, it was basically on the back of something else. But it was, yeah, it wasn't as interesting as his first one, but it was a good journey and
it's more of a story.
Yeah, more personal story.
Cool. And last session of the day, Jeff Patton.
Co-making great products. Yeah, it was, you know, I don't know, it was a bit weird. He started off right at the start saying, I don't like Agile. And the rest of his talk was about Agile. And then, I don't know.
I mean, at the end of the day, he was trying to take you through the thought process of design and working together with the customer, essentially. So he went on a bit of a journey talking about things like the underpants gnomes and those type of things to make sure you're asking the right questions at the design stage through to actually working together with other people in the team.
Which is what Agile should be doing if you're doing it right.
Yeah, I don't recall when he made the statement right at the front, but I suspect
maybe it was a slip,
or a little more controversial, trying to set the scene. I don't know.
Okay.
Don't know.
But yeah, I mean, the rest of it made sense.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the only thing I've seen the longer version of that talk, and I really enjoyed it, where he actually had a lot more. I think that the highlight for that talk for me was the stuff he had right at the end, the pictures, and unfortunately had to sort of barrel through those a little bit because he was short on time. But when he went through the story mapping process and he had sort of short video. I've seen the full time lapse video of where he's showing the wall being done and showing the story maps and those type of things in the process flow.
And, yeah, and I had wished that he spent more time there as well.
And he had a lot more stuff in there about Nordstrom in his longer talk that he didn't get through here. So,
I mean, I was personally, I was quite disappointed in the talk because I'd been looking forward to it so much and was really looking forward to hearing from Jeff Patton and been waiting for it for ages, and it didn't really get, as you alluded to, it didn't get through the whole talk. At times, I felt that he was rambling a bit, but there were the slides and the message at times was clear, and yeah, it was just a shame that the time ran out and he didn't really get to probably what the real point he was trying to make.
I'm not entirely sure whether he did. I said I've seen the longer one, and it was very well formed and was a highlight for me. Yeah. I couldn't say that talk was the highlight at this particular conference for me.
So the highlight for me actually was the final keynote of the evening.
Mike Lee.
Yeah, Mike Lee, the most important minute of your life, which I think is the last minute in his presentation. I'm not quite sure where that minute was.
So I didn't see all the keynote in here. I was doing something else, but I saw a little bit of it. But I saw the one in Melbourne, and for those who saw the one in Melbourne, it was a very, very personal, touching, dark at times, but thought-provoking keynote. I'm assuming on feedback, it was lightened up for this audience, and from the bits I saw of this keynote was entertaining but also thought-provoking, which I think is probably where it needed to be.
Unfortunately, that is where the podcast cut out. If we had the extra time, you would have heard me gush on about how Mike Lee believes that we're nearing the end of our species and the call to action to focus our software creation skills towards solving some of the critical problems of our age. I would like to take this opportunity to thank Peter Sellers for coming onto the podcast and also to thank the YOW organisers for graciously letting us talk to both the speakers and to attend the conference. If you'd like to know more about the YOW, you can find them at www.yowconference.com.au. That's YOW conference.com.au. Thanks for listening to the show. Viva la revolution!